Hey, hi, hello, Hardwood Knox listeners. I am Dan Favalli coming at you with my super duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times, awesome, fantabulous, spectacularia. Wanted me to keep the first introduction recorded in where I was choking co-host Andrew D. Bailey. We have some mea culpas to get to today because, believe it or not, sometimes Andy and I, just sometimes, very rarely, It's like a unicorn, we're wrong. It's just so rare. Barely ever happens. Actually, for me, it happens a lot. But before we get to mea culpa season to close out the year, which we thought would kind of be a good year to self-evaluate, just the usual housekeeping notes. First and foremost, please continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. We can also be found wherever else we're listening. You're listening to your podcast. And if you need to rate and review us on another medium, we'd appreciate that as well. iTunes, though, even if you're not using it, if you could still go in there, throw us a rating, write a review, subscribe. We'd really appreciate it. It helps out the pod a ton. We're always looking for feedback and, again, just for those ratings to go up. But subscribing and downloading our episodes are the number one way to continue helping the podcast. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at Hardwood Knox. Follow Andy on Twitter at Andrew D. Bailey. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Favalli. Follow the Blue Wire Podcast Network and check out all the other cool podcasts we have to offer there, as well as my semi-awesome, at times wildly terrible tweets at Blue Wire Pods. And finally, shout out to our sponsor this week, Untuck It. You'll hear an ad read from them in a little bit, but we appreciate all of our sponsors making this podcast possible. So shout out to them. Andy, how are you doing? How is your Christmas? Are you ready for 2020? How is everything?
It was all great. Christmas was fun. My daughter is four now, so it's like it's becoming this big event. Ben still doesn't quite get it. He's not quite two, but in fact, I think he was kind of sick of presents at one point. but it was a lot of fun. We had a little getaway after Christmas, and now I'm already thinking about buying an Untuck It shirt. So you don't even have to do the ad read. You've already sold me.
No, we're done. There we go.
Paid the bills. How was your Christmas?
My Christmas was it was all right. It was very low key. Watched the basketball. Did a little bit of work. I'm excited because for the past month I've been living in the past because I was working on a decades project that you of which you were kind enough to participate in. And so I was like, after I filed it, it was basically right after Christmas. I like realized it was just when you're living in the past, even when you're watching basketball, I feel like I didn't take in the present as much. So I was doing a lot of catch up watching and research and stuff. So that was how I spent my post-Christmas, I don't even know what you would call it, post-Christmas sabbatical or something with a couple days off. So that was super fun.
Here's an important question. When does the new decade start? Because I've been a little bit bothered by all of this 2010s decade stuff.
In what sense? Like you're saying,
because decade should start at the year one, which would be 2010-11, right? Which would take us through 2019-20.
Yeah, I think if you were doing, when I was doing the research for the most signature moment in every franchise over the past decade, I actually had the cutoff of, I just went from January 1st, 2010, and then technically the end is December 31st, 2019. And I'm just banking on the fact, since it was already published, that nothing's going to happen that would be too signature before the end of the year.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to do it. But with all the decade stuff that's been going on, and I did a decade thing for Bleacher Report too. I did top 50 players of the decade. But I'm always just like, are we really done with the 2010s, or do we have to wait until the end of next year? But that's a
fair question. if you're using all of two, but I feel like the start of the, who the hell knows, actually. That's a technicality. the first question I did want to ask you, though, is about the Utah Jazz, because we took a week off from podcasting. It was the holidays, and both of us had a lot of stuff going on. The Jazz acquired Jordan Clarkson, not a move that I ever would have predicted, but Dante Exum, your boy, and 2 seconds for Jordan Clarkson, who is on an expiring contract. What did you think of that move? What are your impressions of him so far, since he has a couple games under his belt now?
It was unexpected for me too. Not the Exum part of it. I kind of assumed he would get traded at some point this season. I just didn't expect it to be Jordan Clarkson. But the moment I saw the framework of the trade, I liked it for both sides. I think that Clarkson, the criticism around him, I think is fair. He's kind of a shoot first guy. He's never been terribly efficient. He's having an efficient season this season, and obviously there's still plenty of time for that to turn. But even the Jordan Clarkson of years past is an upgrade on what the bench was doing in Utah. They needed somebody who could get his own shot. They needed somebody who tried hard. They were spending so much time with Niang and Jeff Green on the floor together and just getting burned by opposing bench wings. I mean, the bench over under, or the bench plus minus was just awful this season. So I thought this is an interesting move for the Jazz. I liked it pretty much right away. I don't think the price was too much, because Dante Exum was never he was never going to be a valuable piece with Quinn Snyder there. He had made up his mind about Exum 2 or 3 years ago, and so he's already completely out of the rotation. So that part of it was that doesn't affect what Utah's doing right now at all. And then the 2 second round picks, I think you texted me thinking that seemed a little bit steep, and maybe it is. I guess it might depend on where those second round picks end up. But maybe this would be a problem for me if I'm a GM, but second round picks are just such massive question marks to me that I'm not too bent out of shape out of losing those too. So I thought ultimately they gave away three things that might not ever become anything for a guy who I think will help them a decent amount right away. And he's been good so far. It's a very, very short sample. He's just played 2 games with Utah. But kind of what I expected is there. Just having a guy who at least makes the defenses stay honest when he's on the floor will be good for this bench. And sort of a fringe benefit is they're no longer going to throw George Niang out there as a three, which was just I don't understand why they ever thought that would work. If he spends more time as a front court player, maybe he'll get exposed a little bit less. So I think there's a lot of benefits to it. I like it for both sides. I like the fact that Dante Exum's going to get a shot in Cleveland. It'll be interesting to see if he can, you know, make anything of it. But anyway, this is a long, rambling answer. It's the short answer is I liked it for both sides.
Yeah, I think it was ultimately fair. The two second round picks make more sense if you view Dante Exum's $9.6 million salary for next year as just complete dead weight, where it's basically
it would have been
right. It's you. That's how it could be viewed. I guess it's just because he's still intriguing as a. He doesn't really intrigue me on offense anymore, but defensively, it feels like he can really defend three positions, maybe against certain teams, four, if he stays healthy. But that's also another big question mark. Those second round picks, though, I mean, with the 2022 from San Antonio and the 2023 from Golden State, with the way those teams are tracking, there's a chance that they're just early second rounders. And so that's where I was coming from. I don't think that price tag is egregious. And you pointed it out. Was my main impression for the trade was that the Jazz needed someone to put pressure on the defense off the bench. That's held true beforehand, but is now infinitely more true that Joe Ingles is back in the starting lineup. Yeah. And as you alluded to, the Jazz are 27th in point differential per 100 possessions among their reserves. So they need that little punch off the bench. And Clarkson, at least in Cleveland, not through his first couple games of Utah, at least in Cleveland, he was shooting well from three. And so that'll be an interesting fit to monitor. Something that maybe flies under the radar with this, though, is that you take Exum's $9.6 million salary and you turn into a $13.4 million player. And technically, if they wanted to, I'm not saying this is what they should do, but now you can then turn around and trade him for an even more expensive player if there's a seller at the deadline looking to get rid of somebody.
Yeah, somebody, I can't remember who it was, somebody pointed that out. I think it was maybe Andy Larson from the Salt Lake Tribune. Right after the deal went down, and that was an implication that I didn't even think about. And it puts them in range of Andre Iguodala, which would obviously be interesting. Although I think they're – I don't even know if this is what they're thinking about, whether they want to flip him for somebody more expensive, as you just laid out. They're going to give Clarkson a chance to prove what he can do this season, but that is very, very fascinating to me, because that opens up a whole new range of potential guys. It's a little bit difficult because he can't be traded in combination with somebody, correct?
Yeah, I think that's 60 days, which would take them past the trade deadline. But yeah. I'll actually double check that right now.
So he could still be traded in connect, like you could combine him with a pick, I would think, still.
Yes.
So, yeah, maybe that does get them somebody who's even slightly more impactful than Clarkson. There would be a creative way to sort of circumvent the trade rules if they were to do that. But it'll be really interesting to see how he fits over the next few games.
And they have enough room under the tax to where they could use the full weight of that flexibility, where he makes $13.4 million, so you can take back that salary plus $5 million. That's an $18.4 million player. So that's even with, I don't know who that player is, but if the opportunity presents itself to acquire player or players, that's just something to look at. But maybe he performs so well or it becomes a non-issue that they don't even consider it. It's just something that's interesting.
It tops out at 18.3, right? Is that what you said?
18.4.
Okay. So I've got all the player contracts pulled up now. I'm trying to see if there's anybody that's gettable and in that range. And I'm not real – other than Iguodala, I'm not real sure there's anybody else in that range that's maybe like imminently gettable for Utah, but it's a very fascinating idea.
Well, even look, Exum, for if it took Clarkson and a pick or something to get Iguodala, you couldn't have done that with Exum.
No.
And so that's a win. That's a win in itself.
Yeah, for sure.
So that'll be interesting. The other thing I did want to ask you about is so the Kings, just sort of a weird, like, 2 weeks for them. Buddy Hield seemed a little unhappy. He did apologize to his team. Then there's the report that Dwayne Dedman, who's not really part of the rotation anymore and wasn't really a part of the rotation even before Bagley came back from injury. Rashawn Holmes broke out. They have Bielitsa. He requested a trade, which is just – it's funny when players of – I like Dwayne Dedman. I thought everyone – I think his per-year salary, if you're looking at what he did last season, is still an overpay, just of what we know about the center position. That being said, I was a big fan of the dice roll because I thought he would be a nice fit. Clearly, that might be one of my culpas, is I was wrong about that. But it's just funny when a player of his caliber requests a trade. He's on a three-year, $40 million deal. I believe the final year is only partially guaranteed for a million or two. I can double-check that as well. And then there's the whole all-star promotion thing. I don't know if you saw that. I think I showed you where – none of their players are going to make the All-Star game. So I want to make this clear that I'm not saying that Rashawn Holmes should make the All-Star game. But he's been the best player on their team this season by a fairly wide margin. And it might have still been De'Aaron Fox, but he's dealt with injuries. And yet they promoted. Sacramento starts this campaign where they promote basically anyone except him. They launched a campaign to send De'Aaron Fox, Buddy Hield, Marvin Bagley, and Harrison Barnes to the 2020 NBA All-Star game. That just is a weird appropriation of your marketing. I honestly did not understand that at all. And so are they like back in the realm of we need to make Kang's jokes here or something? Just because the Dwayne Dedman trade, someone they just signed over the offseason, or is this just, I don't know. Like, what do you just make of the Sacramento situation right now?
It does seem to be kind of up to their old tricks, I guess. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of a mess right now. I was with you. I thought Dedman would be a lot better for them this season. I just looked up his per possession numbers with Atlanta last year. He was even better than I remember. Per 75 possessions, he averaged 15 points, 10 rebounds, block and a half, steal and a half, almost two threes, a 60-plus true shooting percentage. And that just went sour in Sacramento almost instantly. The Corey Joseph deal hasn't worked out real well either, nor has the Trevor Ariza deal. It seems like some of the young guys, I mean, it's probably not fair to say that De'Aaron Fox has taken a step back because he's missed so much of this season. But he hasn't looked quite as good as he did last season. Rashawn Holmes being clearly their best player is probably not something that many people could have anticipated at this point. I'm looking at their roster now. Can you guess how many of their guys are above average in box plus minus right now?
Three.
Ooh, you nailed it. Nice. And the guys are Rashawn Holmes, Nemanja Bjelica, and De'Aaron Fox. And Fox is just he's not real far above average. So a lot of things have gone wrong for them. And it looked like they were going to have a little resurgence there for a little bit. I don't know, like maybe 2 weeks ago, it seemed like they were closing in on the playoffs again. And then things have kind of spiraled once again. I don't know what it's going to take for the Kings to officially get out of whatever they've been stuck in for the last, what has it been, 20 years now? 15 years probably. So it's just really hard to, we were talking about the Wolves and the Suns before we started recording too. It just seems exceptionally difficult in the NBA to be stuck as a bad team for a long time and to change that. Phoenix got out of the gates pretty hot and everybody was saying, well, Monty Williams has changed the culture. They're going to fix things. And they're right back where they were. The Timberwolves are right back where they were. It's just a really, really difficult thing, to change a team. And as I'm saying this, I'm kind of chuckling because the Timberwolves actually did make the playoffs a couple of years ago with Jimmy Butler. Maybe he's the real culture changer. Oh, cause now Miami's really good.
I guess maybe he's with a bunch of people that don't mind waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever.
Yeah, that went a direction that I didn't anticipate.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It'll be interesting to see how the Kings close out the season. I wouldn't say that Deadman is immovable, but I just don't know what team actually needs him. Not that they don't need him, but like, what are they getting back from? Do they have to include a sweetener at this point? So I, ironically,
million, or, like that's manageable. Like
I think it's just because next year you have to commit to paying him $13.3 million.
Good point.
And then the final year of his deal is guaranteed for $1 million. So that's not a big deal. You can look at it as an expiring. Ironically or not ironically, that the Hawks could use him. So I never understood why they let him walk anyway. Ever see an untucked button down? They look bad. Why? Because they weren't meant to be worn that way. Thankfully, there's Untuckit, the original button-down shirt actually designed to be worn untucked. No matter your size or shape, Untuckit shirts always fall at the perfect untucked length. With more than 50-plus fit combinations, Untuckit shirts look great on tall, short, slim, and athletic guys of all ages. You can find your favorite Untuckit style online or check out one of their 80 brick-and-mortar stores. Choose from styles like wrinkle-free button-downs, super soft flannels, outerwear, and more. With Untuckit, your shirts will never look baggy, bulgy, too long, or too big again. And their website is so easy to use, they even have a whole page devoted to helping you find your fit. So whether you're shopping for the perfect holiday gift or just trying to craft a smart, relaxed style of your own, Untuckit is the way to go. Visit Untuckit.com and use promo code BLUE for 20% off at checkout. That's Untuckit.com and promo code BLUE for 20% off. This might be a good place to start Arme Kolpas, though.
I was going to say that was a natural transition.
My transition is going to be to stay with the Kings, though. So these are just things that we got way wrong. We're not going to, you know, the consensus stuff that we're wrong about, we won't focus on too much, I guess, but just what we individually got wrong in our talks before the preseason. And neither of us are afraid of being wrong, even though Andy claims that he has 100% hit rate on all his takes. But the Kings, for me, I didn't predict that they were going to be really good. I thought De'Aaron Fox was going to end up being a top 20 player this season. That's basically where I put him when I did the top 100. I was encouraged by some of the off-the-dribble threes he hit last year and just his body of work in general. I'm not deplaning the De'Aaron Fox bandwagon, but I was all aboard De'Aaron Fox might be a top 20 player this season. And clearly I was kind of rushing his coronation there.
I guess there's still a chance that they go on some kind of run and get back on track, but it's kind of hard to see that at this point. I thought Buddy Hield was just going to continue to ascend. And it's not that Buddy Hield has been bad. He just hasn't been what he was last year. Right now, his true shooting percentage is like 2.5 points below average. Definitely something I didn't see coming. I thought Bagley would be better this season, and he gets sort of the same pass that we just gave De'Aaron Fox, and that he's been hurt for most of this season. So maybe he'll get back on track. But Bogdan Bogdanovic, I thought, might be a little bit better this season too. It's just like everybody basically, how many guys do you think played to like the peak of their 2018-19 capabilities with the Kings?
As if they won't be better.
Well, just they were as good as we could have expected them to be in 2018-19.
Yeah, that's fair.
It just seems like maybe I should have seen this coming a little bit better than I did. Like, so many things seemed to go right for them last season. And so maybe it was the more cautious approach would have been expecting some sort of a, I don't know if it's like a huge step back, but at least maybe a step towards reality. And it's easier to pinpoint that in hindsight than it is, you know, ahead of time. It was a young team, and you know, this happens to, I think, a lot of us a lot of times, is young team is a little bit better than expected 1 year, and then we just expect that trajectory to keep going, and oftentimes it doesn't happen that way. So this is, you know, if you're a Kings fan, hopefully this is just a detour, and some of these young guys still have plenty of potential. Like, I still think De'Aaron Fox could be a very, very good player. I still think Marvin Bagley could be a very, very good player. It's just maybe we were, at least I was, maybe a year or two too early on this.
Yeah, I was right there with you. I do think maybe there should have been some common sense regression involved. At the same time, you also kind of saw the path to them getting better, maybe, perhaps not making the playoffs, but increasing their win total, even though I believe I selected the under for them when we did that. But De'Aaron Fox, young, and then Marvin Bagley going into his sophomore season had a really nice close to the year. So there was also that idea, well, those guys are only going to get better. And that I thought that was fair. So ended up being a miss on our parts, though. And I missed hard on De'Aaron Fox so far. Still high hopes for him, but this might not have been the year to go all in on it.
Yeah, I still think he could be a very, very good player. And maybe he already is that. He's not.
I ranked him ahead of Chris Paul, is my point in that exercise. So
I remember when you sent me the rankings, I thought that's fairly aggressive on De'Aaron
Fox. You didn't even use the word fairly. You were like, well, that's aggressive.
But I get the fascination with his potential for sure. He's a good leader. He's got incredible speed and handles. Good feel for the pick and roll for a player his age. So I think he'll be fine. And I think, you know, again, if you're a Kings fan, I think you still have some reason for optimism. Maybe this season or the start of this season is just a little bit of a hiccup for them. All right, I'll do one now. Another young team that I thought would just sort of have a linear progression, and they're just nowhere near as good as I thought they would be. I can't remember my exact words, but I believe in the over-under pod or some preseason pod, I said the Atlanta Hawks might be a contender for a playoff spot in the East, and I believe they have the worst record in the league.
They do, and you picked over 34.5 wins for them. I have the receipts, everybody. Do not worry.
Over 34.5 wins. You know, I thought Trae Young was, and I think this is proven correct. I thought he was, you know, he had a chance to be one of the best offensive players in the league. I underestimated what his defense might do to them. He's still, they're just a mess defensively when he's on the floor. I obviously didn't foresee a 25 game suspension for John Collins. But even still, they should be better than worst record in the league. Even without John Collins, I mean, they're just worse than I thought they would be. I was never real high on DeAndre Hunter or Cam Reddish, but I thought, you know, at least Cam Reddish would be playable. He's been a disaster so far this season. I don't know if you saw the thing I posted the other day of guys who are sort of in his statistical profile for rookies, and there's the only name on there who went on to have like a decent career was Will Barton. Other than that, it's a bunch of people that no one's ever heard of. So there's there's a lot going wrong with the Atlanta Hawks right now. I thought they would be better. I just thought they would take a step forward, and they clearly have not.
I was wrong in the sense that I saw the pathway to there. I ended up picking the under for them. I thought they were among the teams that we were rushing, unlike me, who clearly wasn't rushing De'Aaron Fox's development at all. Very level-headed there. So this doesn't surprise me too much. I mean, you couldn't have predicted the John Collins suspension. That being said, their offseason was always tough to sort of wrap your head around with what they did. And I remember doing report card grades for Bleacher Report. And I actually think after I wrote it, I was like, I feel like I was too favorable. I might have given them a C+ or B- or something. But just the, you know, the getting rid of playable NBA players for just, the Bazemore-Turner swap, it felt like they were doing Bazemore solid. You let Dedmon walk when you had the salary cap flexibility to keep him and not really harsh your plasticity moving forward. That was odd. Going all in on DeAndre Hunter like that, where just the price felt like it was bizarre. Okay. Because what you had to take on salary and you had to give up pick, it was just that trade was still, even as DeAndre Hunter looked like he could play make more than I think people thought leading into the year, that was that trade just felt a little off. So their offseason was always a little tough for me to wrap my head around. And I think it's really coming to bear now in their record. And so I'm definitely with you. I don't think anyone thought they were, or at least I didn't think they were going to be the worst team in the league or even contention for it. That was, you know, everyone was talking about the Wizards or the Knicks or the Hornets mainly. So this is definitely surprising. That might be a good next mea culpa to start with. Actually, no, let me start with my own, because I don't want to loop you into this one, because we have a couple collective mea culpas. This is my worst miss of all time, perhaps. The Dallas Mavericks, and I already wrote something on this. I made a joke that they were going to be an 11 seed. It was a joke. But even on this podcast, I picked the under for them at 40.5 wins, and I didn't think they were going to make the playoffs, obviously. And as we record this, they are the number 4 seed in the Western Conference within one win of the second and third seeds in the Western Conference. They are not just winning the minutes without Luka Doncic, who is an MVP candidate, but they're destroying opponents without Luka Doncic on the floor. And I know a lot goes into that, but when he missed those few games and you saw them beat the Bucks, picking up wins like that without him was absolutely incredible. So they were, I never would have said that they were going to have the best offense in the league by a mile. Their offensive rating is 117. Second place is Milwaukee at 114.6. And their defense has been pleasantly average. They're 15th. And that's not something that I really could have predicted. They've done just a good job of, you know, they don't really force turnovers, but they don't foul. And so they seem to have a lot of just good decision makers there. And they have just caught me completely off guard. I was very high on Luka Doncic, but I thought with KP coming back from his ACL injury, that fit being new could be an issue. I wasn't too impressed with their depth, and yet I think they have, you know, we talk about the Jazz's bench, they're 27th in point differential per 100 possession. The Mavericks are first. So I never would have predicted that they had the best bench in the NBA, even when factoring in the Rick Carlisle voodoo that you have to each and every season. That this will be, if they keep this up, one of my biggest misses of all time.
I was higher on the Mavericks than you were, but I think the concern that I pinpointed preseason was the bench. I thought they would have a problem winning minutes when Luka Doncic was not on the floor, and as you just pointed out, that has clearly not been the case. They're phenomenal. They're better than I expected them to be. I thought that they would be sort of scratching and clawing for one of the last couple spots in the West. I didn't think they would be firmly in the playoffs and you know, in the driver's seat for home court advantage. And maybe driver's seat is a little bit too generous because it's pretty tight, like 1-6 in the West right now. But the idea of them missing the playoffs, that's pretty much gone. And they were, even when Luka went down, they surprised me again. Like that Bucks win that you just mentioned, the supporting cast around Luka has been so much better than I thought it would be. And I was thinking about this the other day. Like, not only do they have the best offensive rating of all time right now, do you remember that they were on pace for this same record like 5 or 6 years ago, and then they got the Rondo trade and it derailed them?
Oh boy, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that season, it was once again sort of a random collection of guys that I think a lot of people didn't expect to be very good. And I may be remembering this wrong, but I'm pretty sure they had the best offensive rating of all time at the time they made the Rondo trade, and everything just sort of spiraled out of control after that. You called it the Rick Carlisle voodoo, and maybe there's something to that, because he is just incredible at getting the most out of role players. And I underestimated that. I think a lot of people probably underestimated that, but everybody after Luka and Porzingis has just been phenomenal this season. They've been so much better than I expected. And I think Carlisle deserves an extra shout out for that post-game press conference that he gave a few nights ago, where he talked about how the post up is dead. And that was like a that speech, or whatever we want to call it, that's near and dear to my heart, because that's something that we've been pounding the drum or the table on for weeks and weeks and weeks. They're such a smart organization, and they're just really, really good. I took the over on them, but I did not think I'm sure I sort of hemmed and hawed over it. They're going to smash 40.5.
I don't think you don't have to take a mea culpa there at all. That's entirely on me. So, but what's interesting about them is you mentioned it kind of. So they're winning the minutes without Doncic by about 6 points per 100 possessions, which is huge, just without him being in the lineup. But what really was concerning, and we both alluded to this with the bench, is after that, and Porzingis hasn't even been great for a good part of this year. But when you look at Doncic and Porzingis, the drop off to their third best player, which I still can't really identify who that player is. There are so many different candidates. Might be my guess, but I don't think it's like this clear cut debate. And so the drop off there is bigger than, let's say, the drop off between Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, and the Blazers' third best player, whether it was Zach Collins, Anthony Simons. So that's where the concern was rooted in for me. But the fact that they have the best bench in the league is just, it's crazy.
Yeah, I think anybody who sits there and says, oh, I knew the Dallas bench was going to be this good is lying, because that was really, 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 really difficult to see. And you just mentioned the Blazers. So my next one, if we're done with that, is it's a Blazers player.
Oh, here we go. Been waiting for this.
I am going to hedge a little bit and say there's still time for this to go mildly wrong. But I was wrong about Carmelo Anthony. I just was. He's been better than I thought he would be this season. Right now, his box plus minus is well below replacement level, but Portland's net rating swing is 6.2 with him. They're plus 3.2 points per 100 possessions with him on the court, minus 3 with him off. The record's obviously better since they've signed him. He's averaging 16 points and 6 boards and shooting 40% from 3. He's not really commandeering the offense from what I've seen so far. It still clearly runs through Lillard and McCollum, but he's doing, I think, what everybody kind of wanted him to do, which is provide a little bit of a pressure release for those two guys, hit some open threes. And he's doing it well. He's not going to be like a lockdown defender for the Blazers or anything like that. But based on what he had done in Houston and OKC, what we saw in that playoff series with OKC versus the Jazz, I thought it was done for Melo. I just figured that's it. He's never going to have a positive impact again. And so far through 18 games with the Blazers, he's definitely had a positive impact. And I was just flat out wrong about that.
Yeah, there's, if you're going to sign someone off the street who hasn't played basketball in a year and this is the production you get from him, I think you have to be happy. And I was on the Blazers Edges podcast the other day, and I just wondered if there was something to what I think was overlooked during his time at Houston and OKC. He wasn't necessarily the most gracious person in accepting the roles that he had, but he was taking the shots for the most part that everyone wanted him to. More threes. Yeah. A bunch of catch and shoot looks. He just wasn't hitting them. He's shooting almost 42% on catch and shoot threes in Portland. But I'm also wondering if there's something to the fact that they let him work off the dribble. It's not to the point where it feels domineering necessarily, although there have been some of the games that I've seen him where it feels like, I was looking at his turnover percentage the other day, and it's under 12, and it sometimes just feels like it's way higher watching him. But they do let him work off the dribble. He's not hitting those shots off the dribble at a high clip, but does that help him get in rhythm more for those catch and shoot opportunities because he just has a better feel for the game? I don't know. I just think there's something to them allowing him to explore that, or maybe they're not allowing him so much as they desperately need him to at least try a little bit. And like you said, he's never been a good defender. He's not rebounding at a high clip. He's not finishing around the rim at a high clip for them. He's shooting okay from those in-between zones that he seems to love. 27.1% on long twos, but 43.1% from 10 to 16 feet. So he's been a lot better than I think anyone could have predicted. And then also what's interesting, and it's surprising because I saw some Blazers fans were starting to complain about Terry Stotts. The Blazers have him just screening more, which I think was a criticism dating back to his time in New York where people wanted him to screen more. Melo, when you look specifically at role man possessions, is averaging as many per game as DeAndre Jordan, finishing them anyway. And so I would imagine, I don't have access to this data specifically, but that he's setting even more screens. And while he's not finishing well in those situations, but the Blazers offense, I think Zach Lowe at ESPN wrote about this, is actually pretty efficient in those situations where he's being used as the screener overall. And so that's a credit to Melo himself, but also Terry Stotts. And so I've enjoyed it. And it's cool that he's not done, because I always liked him. I thought he was overrated, but I liked him. And the debate of whether he's a Hall of Famer or not, I think has gotten out of control. And it's just the players of his caliber. I know a lot of this is self-inflicted. I don't really like seeing them go out just in such this, I don't want to say ruthless fashion, but in an unsavory fashion. And so it's nice that he's playing well enough to where, if this was his last season, it's a semi-high note, or it's cool that now his career can sort of end on his own terms. Because if he finishes the year like this, regardless of what happens with the Blazers, there will be other teams that want him next year. I'm not saying he'll get a payday in free agency. Whoever's paying an age 56 Carmelo Anthony in free agency, that's look, that's going to be on you when the returns aren't good. But it's cool to see that he has rebuilt some of his functional goodwill on the court.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with all that. That was just a big whiff for me.
Are you okay with me doing what our collective mea culpas were very quickly? And then I'll get to one that's just me.
Let's do it.
I have three for us. And I think the Wizards are just a universal one. I did not see them being remotely entertaining. I just don't, their offense has fallen off, but they're still eighth in offensive efficiency. Davis Bertans hasn't missed since 2018, I don't think. And so...
Do I get any credit for Bertans?
Look, I'm still not – the Spurs look bad, but I think if they actually got Marcus Morris, that I wouldn't view Bertans as such this huge loss. I think Marcus Morris is a better player and did more of what would have helped the Spurs than Bertans did. Just because his style was just never going to mesh with San Antonio's. They didn't let him shoot that many threes or didn't play him enough to have him shoot that many threes.
So they deserve to be burned twice for letting go of him and for not playing him right.
All right. That's one way to look at it, too. So those were ones. And then these ones were – Charlotte is probably more of a universal miss. They're not good. But they're fun bad because they have the 27th point differential in the league, I believe it was last time I checked. Maybe they've moved up a little bit. They are. They're 25th. So congratulations to Charlotte. But they might make the playoffs. They have 13 wins, and they're over-under when we recorded – was 23.5, and we both took the under without even hesitating.
Yep.
And so unless they just blow it up, they might actually hit that, and they might make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference. They are three games in the loss column out of the 8-seed Orlando Magic. They probably won't, but they're not the worst team in the league. I actually like watching them. I enjoy PJ Washington. I still enjoy Miles Bridges. I'm not ready to give up on him. And then Devontae Graham has been spectacular this year. And the final one, I don't know if this – I guess they are technically contending for a playoff spot, but I do think that us and many others were ready to declare the Bulls like this fun upstart all of a sudden, and they are kind of not so much.
So with the Wizards and the Hornets, I think the easy out for all of us is no one could have seen – I mean, even I who I was high on Davis Bertans and I didn't understand the trade. I didn't think he'd be as good as he's been. I don't think anybody could have expected their offense to be what it is this season. So that wasn't an egregious miss by us. That roster in the preseason just looked awful. And then with Charlotte, I don't think anybody could have seen the Devontae Graham ascension either. He just came out of nowhere and he's been phenomenal this season. The Bulls. The Bulls is
I wish I could forget about the Bulls too.
That one's harder to explain away. And to this day I still don't really know, is it just boiling? Like are they using these guys wrong? Because when I look at that roster, it still makes sense to me. I don't look at that and think, you know, here's my obvious miss. Here's the thing that no one could have seen coming. A lot of those pieces still fit together. Like maybe the obvious one is Lauri Markkanen. I think all of us expected him to be quite a bit better than he has. Other than that, it's kind of hard to pinpoint this is where it all went wrong. Otto Porter's been out for a lot of the season, but it's hard to, you know, put all of Chicago's struggles on that. So Chicago's the head scratcher to me of those three that you just outlined.
That feels like it might be a coaching situation, but you know that,
yeah, it probably is.
So yeah, I agree with you there that the Hornets and the Washington were more universal misses or misconceptions, and that the Bulls were a team. We both picked the over for them at 33.5.
Yeah.
I'll go to a lone miss for me so that you're not included in it. I won't call this a miss, but I'm just going to say I was wrong. I took Heat from them. I was probably overly concerned about the Milwaukee Bucks this season. It wasn't just that they lost Malcolm Brogdon, but their secondary wing rotation to me felt like it wouldn't hold up. And I think there are still people that are concerned about how their shot creation will translate into the playoffs this year, which I still believe is fair. That is something to question. Giannis, though, this season has already hit more off the dribble threes than he did all of last year. That's
crazy.
He's not hitting them at a super high clip, but if he's going to take them, you can leverage him as a threat in that way, and that helps. Yep. We both, I believed, yes, we picked the under for 57.5 for them, and they're currently on pace at 29-5 to win, what does that amount to, over 82 games? 67 games this season. They have the second best offense in the league. Their defense is first in points up per 100 possessions right now. They've navigated some adversity. They've had some injuries. Chris Middleton, Eric Bledsoe, Brook Lopez wasn't hitting wide open threes to start the season.
Giannis has probably missed, you know, 3 or 4 games at this point too.
Yeah, and look, the Giannis at center lineups are finally just steamrolling opponents. I think I sent you something about this a week or two ago. They weren't a net minus all the time, but they had seldom gone to it. He's already logged a career high number of possessions at center. And so that's just another thing to look at. Can that hold up in the playoffs? Those are all fair questions, but I think I was too cautious with them, which was ultimately unfair to Milwaukee. Giannis is just out of this world. And look, again, there are some things that I'm still going to wonder about leading into the postseason. I do, however, think, one, as a perennial Chris Middleton defender, that their secondary stars, if you want to call them that, are almost underrated at this point. He's someone who's shown that his shot creation can hold up in the playoffs. I know the half-court offense fell apart against Toronto, but maybe it's just different this year because I do think Middleton is that good of a player where he could be better. And then the other thing to sort of monitor is that Eric Bledsoe has not been good the past two postseasons. I think it would be ambitious, let's put it, to say that he's going to be good this year in the postseason, but he has shown to me, just in the games that I've watched, just a little bit more one-on-one juju. He's averaging 1.3 points per ISO possession this year. 1.3. That's better than the league's best offense. Only 10% of his plays. But if you can count on that as even this accessory part of his game, I do think that's important. So somehow only me would need to do a mea culpa on a team that is on pace to win 66, 67 games right now.
Well, I took the under on them too. 57.5 just sounded so high at the time. And I still thought they would be very good and possibly the best team in the East, but they're going to, like you said, they're on pace for mid to high 60s, which is obviously a lot higher than 57.5. I underestimated some of those potential Brogdon replacements too. Like I like Pat Connaughton. I've always thought he's a little bit underrated, but I think he's been better than expected. I think Dante DiVincenzo has obviously been quite a bit better than many expected him to be. So I missed on them too, so don't feel too bad. I had one. Oh, the Pelicans are one that I was going to go to. I took the over on their 39.5. You wisely took the under. last I checked, and let me pull this up again real quick, they are now they're 11-23. Can you guess what their chance to make the playoffs is in 538's projection?
Their chance?
Yeah.
I'm going to say less than 5.
42%.
What?
I don't know.
Are they waiting the four-game winning streak? I don't understand.
What I did when I first saw that the other day, it was at 30. And even at 30, I thought, what? That's wild. So I looked up remaining strength of schedule. They have the third easiest remaining strength of schedule in the league. And maybe the projection is just defaulting back to what they thought the Pelicans would be before the season started. And we factor in the fact that the seventh and eighth seeds in the West might both be below 500 this season. So at 11 and 23, say they finish with like 37, 38 wins. Maybe that's in contention for a playoff spot, but 42% just sounds really, really high. Anyway, that's my long-winded way of trying to justify the fact that I was in on them this preseason, but I they're not going to get to 40 wins, which is what I said when I took the 39.5 over. I thought Lonzo Ball would be better. I also missed on Brandon Ingram just the other way. Incidentally, he's been better than I expected, but a lot of the other pieces just haven't fit together quite as well as I expected. Derek Favors spending a lot of the season injured is probably something that I should have expected, but just didn't. I thought he would make perfect sense for them right off the bat. I guess overall, similar to the Bulls, I just looked at that roster and thought these pieces fit together in my mind, and so I could see them being solid. And they haven't been as good as I thought they would be.
They do have, I think it's like the best defense in the league since Derek Favors returned to the lineup.
Yeah.
Over that eight or nine game span.
I just needed Derek Favors' injury history to be gone all of a sudden.
I think you can at least chalk those up, a lot of maybe their struggles up to injuries. You know, Lonzo Ball hasn't been healthy. Drew Holiday seemed banged up to start the year. They don't have Zion Williamson, obviously. Maybe I'm just setting up my next mea culpa as an excuse. I bought way too much Golden State Warriors stock.
Yeah.
I'm actually, when we were looking at this and I looked in our super secret official Hardwood Knox document, that you picked the over at 48.5 as well. Did I like make an impassioned plea for you to join me?
No, I have no excuse for myself either.
I picked Stephen Curry to win MVP. I thought they were going to make the playoffs as a top four, top five seed. I was wrong. And look, we could not have predicted the spate of injuries that they suffered. Russell has missed time. Stephen Curry is still on the shelf. Green has missed a little bit of time. Looney got injured. But I knew they weren't going to have Klay Thompson. I knew Kevin Durant had left. And when Stephen Curry got injured, they were still, I think, the worst team in basketball. And so they've perked up a little bit over the past couple weeks, where people have now started to joke about, hey, if Steph comes back and they're like within five or six games of the playoffs – this team is still 9-25, and they were tracking towards a similar fate with Stephen Curry in the lineup. And so I missed on them in some form. If injuries can alleviate some of that, then I will welcome it. But if they can't, I totally understand, because they were bad with him. And so that's a team that I really need to make a retraction on.
Yeah, I was off on them too. speaking of those 538 projections, even with their recent uptick, they're the only team in the league that's at less than 1% chance to get into the playoffs. And I think they'll be abundantly cautious with Stephen Curry, knowing that the chances of doing anything with him this season are extremely low. They're going to protect that draft pick they've got coming. So I don't think we're in danger of seeing a late season Warriors run to the playoffs. And like you said,
it would be hysterical if that's what happened, though.
Yeah, it would be amazing. I took the over on them too. I was wrong. There was a little part of me that was there was a little piece of me that wanted to be more critical and take the under, but they had just been so dominant for half a decade, and it was one of those things where you're like, well, I just have to see it before I say that they're done, or you know, kind of the typical line that we throw at the Spurs over the last several years. And now we are absolutely seeing it. So maybe they bounce back. I don't know if this draft is good enough to give them their Tim Duncan moment, like, you know, when the Spurs had that one terrible year and got Tim Duncan at number one. There's clearly not that guy. Mm-hmm. In this draft, but maybe if Stephen Curry is fully healthy and Klay Thompson is 95% of what he was before the ACL, they can make one more run at it next season. But right now it's not looking good.
Do you have another one?
Let me scan here.
I have one more, so I can do that while you're scanning. And I'm not, I think it's a TBD one, but at the start of the season, I was probably riding too much of a, and I'm normally pretty good about not reading too much into the preseason and summer league, but I wrote about how this draft class was going to be deeper than advertised. Mm. And there's still a level of TBD there, just because you have guys like Matisse Thybulle, maybe Kobe White gets better as well. Tyler Hero's been a nice surprise, but you know, the Nickeil Alexander-Walker stuff, I bought into that, and he really hasn't matched that hype that he built up. You know, Darius Baisley was hitting threes to start the year. But then you go back and forth because Brandon Clark has been amazing. John Morant looks like a franchise player. But then you go back and forth again because RJ Barrett sort of looks in between, but you chalk that up to him suffering from a case of playing for the Knicks. I still think that's up in the air. We haven't seen enough of these guys, some of these guys, you know, Gogo Batadze, Sekou Doumbouya, to really make any sweeping conclusions. But I think I was a little bit too ambitiously optimistic about this draft class after the first few weeks of the season.
This class is kind of a hard one to evaluate. And I think you just pinpointed a lot of the things that makes it difficult. It could wind up being one of those years where the best players in the draft were taken outside the lottery.
Right, because it's like, you know, it's cool to have Eric Pascal, you know, becoming a part of the Warriors, yeah, or PJ Washington, but yeah, then, you know, Jarrett Culver and Cam Reddish have not been very good.
Terrible. Brandon Clark has been phenomenal. Some of his advanced numbers are amazing. I did a little thing on him for the Bleacher Report NBA Digest a couple weeks ago. His percentage in the floater zone is just unbelievable. He's got incredible touch.
And you hate the floater zone too, so that's...
I know. Unless you're otherworldly at it, like Brandon Clark.
He's always moving. I was watching their game.
He's awesome.
I don't remember who they were playing. He's just always moving.
Yeah. I love the Grizzlies' young core. I love Brandon Clark. I think John Morant's going to be good. Can we still count Kyle Anderson as part of a young core? He's probably in his mid-20s at this point, so maybe not. I like what they're building in Memphis. So that's probably a good one to pinpoint, but that is a tough draft class to evaluate. I actually found one that's pretty obvious for me that I probably should have pinpointed last night. I took the under on the Los Angeles Lakers at 49.5 wins. I still have some questions about their supporting cast, but they've just been a lot better than I thought they would be. And the other thing that I was maybe leaning on is there have been so many seasons where LeBron James, basically assembles a super team, obviously with Miami, and then he did it in Cleveland. And there always seemed to be a little bit of an adjustment period. It's like there was no adjustment period whatsoever with him and AD, and maybe this is the kind of player he should have been paired with all along. And it's obviously hard to say, let's go find an Anthony Davis guy and pair him with LeBron James, but
right,
the plug and play nature of that duo has just been incredible. Last I checked, the top assist duo in the league was those two guys, and it was by a huge margin. That has just worked about as well as it possibly could. And then they've had a bunch of guys that have just been, we've said this about a few teams, but they've just been better than expected. Dwight Howard has obviously been better than a lot of people anticipated that he would be. Alex Caruso has been effective for them. They've had a lot of guys who have, just maybe not like blown the doors off expectations, but have been good or a little bit better than expected. And when you have a top two that's as good as Davis and LeBron, or a top three if we want to throw Danny Green in there, if you can just get solid contributions from other guys, that's all you need. So I was way off on the Lakers. Picking the under on 49.5 is going to look terrible, because I just did the pace that they're on, and they're on pace for 60 plus wins too. So they're gonna obliterate that 49.5.
Yeah, that was, you weren't alone, but that's going to look, if they get into like the mid to high 50s, that's not going to look so great.
And I think they're going to get to 60. I mean, the one thing with them is they're one significant injury away from being in deep, deep trouble. And that's just kind of the construction of their roster. And that's the nature of trading essentially your whole team for one guy. But they've just been, as long as everybody's in the lineup, they've just been absurd this season. And pardon me if I'm rambling at this point, but LeBron James doing what he's doing in his age 35 season is just ridiculous. I don't know if you saw this the other day, but I posted a blind comparison of LeBron this season versus the 25-year-old LeBron. So 10 years ago, and you know, the 25-year-old LeBron is one of his best seasons ever, and he comfortably won the blind comparison poll. But he's putting up comparable numbers as a 35-year-old. He's posting his highest assist average of his career. What he's doing at this age is just absurd. I mean, no one else has come close to this, I don't think.
I'm with you, and I don't necessarily understand the argument of people who think that AD is more valuable to the Lakers than LeBron at this point.
Close.
There's look, in the minutes LeBron plays without AD, the Lakers are plus 8.5 points per 100 possessions. That's a 732 possession sample size. In the minutes Davis plays without LeBron, the Lakers are minus 0.3 points per 100 possessions. And he's played a similar amount of time without LeBron as well. I think that just highlights the importance of LeBron's just table setting for everybody, because you could say, well, there's a big difference when Davis goes from playing with LeBron to Rondo. And that's sort of the point, that Davis is still reliant on offense to a higher level creator or someone who could do that to some degree, where he can't really define your team on that end, defensively for sure, but he's not someone who could define or carry your team on offense for, I would say, extended stretches anyway. So top five, top seven player for sure. But to me, if we're doing MVP ballots, I think LeBron is comfortably ahead of AD for me.
Oh, he's easily ahead of AD for me. I was curious, you know, based on the statement that I threw out a couple minutes ago. Here are the best age 35 or older box plus minuses for a season. Number five, Charles Barkley at 5.5, and he's actually tied with a bunch of guys. So Bird had a 5.5 season. Duncan had a 5.5. David Robinson had a 5.5. Number four is Karl Malone at 5.9. Number three is Karl Malone at 6.8. Number two is Karl Malone at 6.9. And number one is LeBron James at 9. Wow. So way ahead of the rest of the top five. What he's doing is just it's unreal at his age and the amount of minutes that he's played over the course of his career. It's just I don't know what else we can say about LeBron at this point. But again, I was wrong about the Lakers.
That does it for me. Amame Culpas. Do you have any more? My biggest ones, anyway.
I'm sure I have some more, and maybe the listeners can remember some crazy things that I said and throw them back at me on Twitter at Andrew D. Bailey. And if you want to do the same thing to Dan, I'm sure he will thoroughly appreciate that at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at Blue Wire, or that's the podcast host is at Blue Wire Pods. The sponsor is at NBA_math. As always, we encourage you to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. If you've already done that, tell your friends, family, neighbors, acquaintances, people you bump into on the street, all that stuff. Tell them, hey, Hardwood Knox, pass it on. Until next time, we leave you with a shout out to Ben Oudry and Kyle Anderson.